Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight.
We'll stand in solidarity against Russia's aggression, period.
The world stage. President Biden calls on global leaders to counter Russia's invasion of Ukraine as Vladimir Putin drafts 300,000 more soldiers for the war effort. Then, fighting inflation. The Federal Reserve again raises interest rates to combat rising prices, and central banks around the world follow suit. And the aftermath. In the wake of Hurricane Fiona, Puerto Rico begins a long recovery process, while much of the island is still left in the dark and without running water. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. We have two lead stories tonight. The Federal Reserve has raised interest rates to their highest level in 14 years in a move to fight inflation. But we begin with the largest escalation of the war in Ukraine since the Russian invasion. Overnight, Russia's President Vladimir Putin announced a draft of hundreds of thousands of military reservists. President Biden and the world are responding today at the annual UN General Assembly. Nick Schifrin is in New York, and he begins our coverage.
On the 210th day of Russia's war in Ukraine, as a Russian rocket left yet another Ukrainian home a mangled mess. As Ukrainian soldiers maintain their momentum, evicting Russian occupiers and capturing equipment as Russian troops flee for their lives, President Vladimir Putin launched Russia's largest mobilization since World War II.
Only military reservists, primarily those who served in the armed forces, will be called up. I have already signed the executive order on partial mobilization.
Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu promised to deploy an additional 300,000 veterans, doubling the number of Russian troops already committed to Ukraine. And in an echo of 2014 in Crimea, Putin endorsed referenda in occupied Ukrainian territory that the U.S. believes will lead to annexation.
We will do everything necessary to create safe conditions for these referenda so people can express their will, and we will support their choice for the future.
Western weapons have helped Ukraine survive and beat Russia back. Putin said the West, quote, had gone too far and unleashed what the U.S. today called a nuclear threat.
Our country has different types of weapons as well, and some of them are more modern than the weapons NATO countries have. In the event of a threat to the territorial integrity of our country and to defend Russia and our people, we will certainly make use of all weapon systems available to us. This is not a bluff.
If nations can pursue their imperial ambitions without consequences, then we put at risk everything this very institution stands for.
4,500 miles away, President Biden addressed the annual UN General Assembly that Putin annually boycotts and called Putin's ambitions in Ukraine total.
This war is about extinguishing Ukraine's right to exist as a state, plain and simple, and Ukraine's right to exist as a people. Whoever you are, wherever you live, whatever you believe, that should make your blood run cold.
Biden called the war a shameless violation of the very principle on which the UN was founded.
You cannot seize a nation's territory by force. The only country standing in the way of that is Russia.
Greetings to all people of the world.
This afternoon, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged the world to help Ukraine quickly before Russia can freeze the front lines ahead of the winter.
It was to prepare fortifications on occupied land and carry out military mobilization at home. We cannot agree to a delayed war because it will be even hotter than the war now. For us, this is a war for life.
In Moscow, the mobilization sparked fury. A rare demonstration against the war ended with what independent rights groups said were more than 1,000 arrests.
Men and women chosen to represent the vast majority of mankind in this new effort to make life safe for the ordinary citizen throughout the globe.
The UN General Assembly launched 76 years ago in the aftermath of two world wars in one generation. President Biden harked back to those 1946 delegates' decision to try and bridge a divided world, and today ended with a rallying cry of hope.
The challenges we face today are great indeed. but our capacity is greater. Our commitment must be greater still. We're not passive witnesses to history. We are the authors of history. We can do this. We have to do it for ourselves and for our future, for humankind.
Yes, it's the first.
But the very structure of the United Nations, Russia, of course, has a permanent veto on the Security Council, prevents this institution from having very much influence over the war in Ukraine. And that means, Judy, the war will be determined by the Ukrainian military to fight back against Russia and the West's ability gain the support that Ukraine so badly needs.
Nick, a lot going on. And you were telling us there's also been talk today in New York about what has happened at the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, the largest nuclear plant in Europe, that there's discussion about its safety. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Rafael Grossi, the director general of the IAEA, the UN's nuclear watchdog, is here doing shuttle diplomacy. He met earlier today with Ukrainian Foreign Minister Kuleba, and then after that with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to try and create a safe zone around that plant. That would include removing the Russian vehicles that are inside the plant and getting Russia to stop doing what the U.S. believes it is doing, and that's deliberately sabotaging the electricity lines going in and out of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Now, the electricity concerns have abated in the last week or so, Judy, but there was a new incident today that Grossi detailed that a pool where spent nuclear fuel is cooled actually stopped operating because there was an explosion at a nearby pipeline. Lastly, Judy, just a little bit of good news. There's been a prisoner swap between Ukraine and Russia moderated by the Saudis, and that includes the release of two Americans who had been held for 3 months and who had been sentenced to death. They are now free tonight.
Interesting timing there. And finally, Nick, we know that Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, spoke today at the UN. Tell us what he said.
Yeah, Ibrahim Raisi spoke at the UN and was defiant. At one point, he even held up a photo of Qasem Soleimani. That is, of course, the former Quds Force commander that was killed by a U.S. drone during the Trump administration. Raisi said that we will, quote, continue down that path steadfastly, referring to the nuclear advancements that his country have made since leaving the Iran nuclear deal. But what he did not address, Judy, are those protests that have spread throughout Iran over the last 5 days over the death of a 22-year-old who died in Iranian custody. In those protests, seven people have been killed. Those protests continued today. And today, Judy, President Biden said of the protests, "We stand with the women of Iran who are simply demonstrating for their basic rights."
Nick Schifrin reporting on it all for us from the United Nations in New York. Thank you, Nick. As we said a moment ago, another major news story today, and that is the Federal Reserve once again raising its key interest rate by 0.75 points in order to beat back inflation. So far, the Fed has increased rates by 3 points this year. The benchmark short-term rate has now reached its highest level since 2008, and with Fed Chair Jay Powell saying today that, quote, "There's still a long way to go," it looks like the Fed's key rate will jump at least one more point before year's end. Other countries are following suit, posing more risks. Economics correspondent Paul Solman has the story.
The Fed's unusually aggressive third straight 0.75 point interest rate hike is part of its ongoing struggle to tame inflation. Chairman Jay Powell today.
Inflation is running too high. You don't need to know much more than that. If that's the one thing you know that, this committee is committed to getting to a meaningfully restrictive stance of policy and staying there until we feel confident that inflation is coming down.
Despite previous rate hikes, Powell noted that jobs remain unfilled throughout the economy.
So far, there's only modest evidence that the labor market is cooling off. We think that we'll need to bring our funds rate to a restrictive level and to keep it there for some time.
Former New York Fed Executive Vice President Krishna Guha explained the mechanics.
So the Federal Reserve is trying to increase the cost of borrowing, tighten what are called financial conditions more broadly, in order to reduce demand in the economy and bring it into better balance with supply, which continues to be somewhat impaired following the pandemic. The hope is that by doing so, they can help generate a reduction in what is currently very elevated inflation.
What are the risks?
It raises the risk that at some point at least, the Fed might overshoot and raise rates too much, pushing the economy into a recession that perhaps didn't need to happen.
Today, Chair Powell acknowledged that risk.
No one knows whether this process will lead to a recession, or if so, how significant that recession would be. That's going to depend on how quickly wage and price inflation pressures come down, whether expectations remain anchored, and whether, you know, also do we get more labor supply, which would help as well.
Now, it's not just the Federal Reserve. Most central banks in the world are raising rates.
The effect of a rate hike in one country, of course, spills over into others as well. So the whole is more than the sum of the parts of this tightening. And that certainly presents risks to growth. But at the same time, of course, it is the case, it's very important for central banks to avoid a return to the 1970s, where high and variable inflation became entrenched, causing great misery for households, difficulties for business, poor economic performance. So they are doing this for a reason. The problem, of course, is that it's going to be hard to thread the needle, restore price stability, while sustaining ongoing global growth and employment.
Already here in the U.S., higher interest rates have hiked mortgage rates above 6% for the first time since 2008, slowing home sales. And of course, the stock market is down.
When the Fed raises the interest rate, and particularly as today, signals that it expects to raise rates appreciably further from here, that pushes up all borrowing costs and longer-term borrowing costs, as well as short-term borrowing costs, so costs on your mortgage, for instance, costs on an auto loan, costs on other consumer credit. It's also the case that when interest rates go up, the value of assets that generate dividends like shares also tend to go down.
What next? Well, today, the Fed revised its median forecasts for unemployment and inflation upward, predicting 4.4% unemployment by the end of next year and a core inflation rate of 4.5% by December, and projected they would raise the Fed funds rate by at least another 1.25 point by the end of the year. We'll all get to see if those projections are more accurate than the recent Fed forecasts that so underpredicted the inflation we now face. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
In the day's other news, New York State sued former President Trump, his three eldest children, and his company, alleging business fraud. The civil lawsuit says they inflated Mr. Trump's net worth by billions of dollars by exaggerating the value of his key real estate properties. New York State Attorney General Letitia James announced the lawsuit in Manhattan.
Claiming you have money that you do not have does not amount to the art of the deal. It's the art of the steal. And there cannot be different rules for different people in this country or in this state. And former presidents are no different.
Mr. Trump called the suit a witch hunt by a Democratic official. We'll take a closer look later in the program. The U.S. House of Representatives today approved a bill to block future attempts at subverting presidential elections. It's a direct response to the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol and closes loopholes in a centuries-old law. The Trump camp tried to exploit those loopholes to overturn the 2020 election results. A similar bill is pending in the Senate. Hurricane Fiona has grown into a Category 4 storm with winds of 130 miles an hour. The storm slowly swirled toward Bermuda late today. It is forecast to arrive there by Thursday night or early Friday. In its wake, roughly 1 million homes and businesses in Puerto Rico still have no power, and 1.3 million people have no running water. In Pakistan, medical workers struggle today to contain malaria outbreaks as swarms of mosquitoes breed in the wake of catastrophic flooding. The disease is spreading in refugee camps where hundreds of thousands of people face desperate conditions. In addition to sickness, many are going hungry.
Our problem is food. They give us a 1 kilogram packet of cooked rice every morning. I have a huge family. How is this going to feed all the men, women, and children in our family?
Pakistani officials say the floodwaters spanning hundreds of square miles won't entirely recede for up to 6 months. Back in this country, Robert Sarver, the owner of the Phoenix Suns and the Phoenix Mercury pro basketball teams, announced that he is selling both franchises. It comes a week after he was suspended by the NBA over allegations of racist and anti-female speech. Sarver bought the teams in 2004. And on Wall Street, the latest interest rate hike pushed stocks lower. Major indexes fell 1.7% or more. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 522 points to close at 30,183. The NASDAQ fell nearly 205 points. The S&P 500 shed 66. And a new monument in Missouri now officially marks the center of the country. It was unveiled today in the small town of Hartville, east of Springfield. It signifies the geographic center of how the U.S. population is distributed. The population center is calculated every 10 years after the latest census. We'll have to go take a look. Still to come on the NewsHour, the details of the New York Attorney General's lawsuit against former President Trump and his children. We speak with the president of Poland about Vladimir Putin's moves to escalate the war in Ukraine. A sheriff opens an investigation into Florida's decision to fly migrants to Martha's Vineyard, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we reported, the Attorney General of New York is suing former President Donald Trump and his private company for financial fraud. Our John Yang has more on the latest development in Mr. Trump's legal battles.
Judy, New York Attorney General Letitia James's civil suit alleges that the former president and executives of the Trump Organization, including his three oldest children, lied to bankers and insurers for years by inflating the value of their real estate holdings in violation of New York state law. James can't bring criminal charges in this case, but suggests that federal laws may have been broken as well. She's referred the case to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan and to the IRS. We look at two aspects of this with Andrea Bernstein, who covers the former president's legal issues for NPR, and Jessica Roth, a former federal prosecutor, now a professor at the Cardozo School of Law. Thanks to you both for joining us. Andrea, let me begin with you. You have watched these investigations of the former president closely for a while now. To you, what is the significance of what happened today?
Well, I think what was really striking was to hear today the New York Attorney General say aloud that this had been a pattern and practice of the Trump Organization for, as she put it in her complaint, at least a decade. That is, take Trump's apartment in Trump Tower. According to the complaint, the apartment was valued for an apartment three times its size, a $200 million difference, making it valued at the time for as the most expensive apartment in New York City. So according to the Attorney General, what the president did is then take this to bankers and say, I have all this money, and get more favorable rates. Well, this happened, according to the complaint, over 200 times. It was central to Trump's business model. It was a pattern of fraud that went on and on and on.
Jessica Roth, there is a referral to the U.S. Attorney's Office and for the Southern District of New York. You worked in that office. What typically happens when a referral comes over like this?
Well, the U.S. Attorney's Office will make an independent assessment of the evidence. It would also conduct its own investigation and would make a determination about whether there is enough evidence to proceed with criminal charges. The burden of proof in a criminal case is considerably higher than the burden in a civil case. The burden in the criminal case is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So even if all the allegations in this complaint are accepted as true, the U.S. Attorney would have to be satisfied that he'd be able to persuade a jury unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt of criminal intent by each of the individuals alleged here, not just the corporation.
Andrea Bernstein, we've said that the Trump reaction to this has been is that this is a political witch hunt. The former president did respond on the Truth social media site in a political way. He said, Attorney General Letitia Peekaboo James, a total crime-fighting disaster in New York, is spending all of her time fighting for very powerful and well-represented banks and insurance companies who were fully paid, made a lot of money, and never had a complaint about me, instead of fighting murder and violent crime, which is killing New York State. Now, the Attorney General has emerged as sort of the one of the leading antagonists of the former president. She's a Democrat. She was talking about running for governor for a while. What role does politics or is politics playing in all of this, in your view?
Well, according to the judge in this investigation, it doesn't matter. This has been a running argument that's been going on since January in New York State Supreme Court, whether the attorney general was entitled to get information from the former president and his company, or whether she is just trying to get it to embarrass the former president and his company. And what the judge in the case has ruled is it doesn't matter that the New York attorney general is a Democrat. It doesn't matter that she talked when she was running for office about investigating Trump. What matters are the facts and the law. And this case has already survived several hurdles. And in New York, in a civil case like this, a case is already quite advanced. The Attorney General has gotten a lot of information, millions of pages of documents, she said. She, of course, we all remember, interviewed the former president. He took the Fifth Amendment 500 times. She talked about that in her press conference today. So the case is far along, and the evidence is out there. And a judge has said, politics doesn't matter. It's going to be tested in the courts.
And Andrea, real estate valuations are often subjective. So how is what's being alleged in this civil suit, how out of the ordinary is this for real estate?
Right. So I've covered Trump's business for a long, long time, and I've covered real estate in New York for a long time. And certainly there is a lot of sort of puffery about what the value of a property may be. But what the attorney general was saying is this was so far out of bounds, hundreds of millions of dollars in individual cases adding up to more than $1 billion, that there were actual victims, the taxpayers of New York, who didn't get the taxes they were entitled to, banks, insurance companies. And that, she says, is something that if you were an average person, you lied in a bank application, you could be liable for that. She's saying it doesn't matter if you're the former president, you should be too.
Jessica Roth, Andrea talks about the puffery in real estate. When you talked to us earlier, you talked about these allegations and claims being objectively verifiable, and you talked about the importance of that. Explain what you meant by that.
Yeah, because I think that the attorney general anticipated that the defense here was likely to be that these are the kinds of practices that are routinely engaged in the real estate industry. I think she was wise to make her allegations as concrete as possible and grounded in representations that were made that could be shown to be objectively false. So, for example, the square footage that Andrea talked about, for example, of the former president's apartment that was grossly inflated in some of the statements. If that's an objective fact, what's the square footage of the apartment? So things like that, or whether or not statements were prepared with the input of outside professionals, that can be verified, whether in fact outside professionals gave their sanction to the statements. And according to the allegations in the complaint, some of those outside professionals were interviewed by the attorney general, and they did not provide input of the kind that's described in the statements or sanction them in any way. So that's what I mean, that it's smart as a litigation strategy to stick to facts that can be verified and proven to be false.
And Jessica Roth, based on the allegations in this suit, what potential federal charges do you see possible here?
Well, they include the charges that are actually mentioned in a footnote in this complaint, including wire fraud and bank fraud. So those would involve frauds committed upon financial institutions, banks, and use of the wires in furtherance of any other kind of fraud. It could include the bank fraud, it could include insurance fraud. And so anytime interstate wires are used to further a scheme to defraud, that can count as wire fraud under the federal statutes. So that's what the U.S. attorney is going to be looking at in addition to the evidence. What are the federal statutes that may have been violated here?
Former federal prosecutor Jessica Rothnow at Cardozo Law School and Andrea Bernstein of NPR. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ukraine's largest neighbor on its western border is Poland, a NATO and European Union member that has had its own long and violent history with Russia. As Vladimir Putin looks to accelerate the war, I sat down in New York early this afternoon with Poland's President Andrzej Duda. President Duda, thank you very much for talking with us. Let's start with Ukraine. You've just listened to President Biden's remarks at the United Nations, where he said what President Putin has done taking over territory that doesn't belong to him, and now with this overt threat of nuclear weaponry, that it should make our blood run cold. Is that how you take what's going on?
Russia is in a difficult situation. Russia has demonstrated its weakness. What Russia has been doing so far in Ukraine, the aggression and all the outrageous dimensions of the war which Russia demonstrated in Ukraine, as a matter of fact, have turned out to be a failure of Russia. Russia tries to change its tactics at the same time it tries to threaten the world with nuclear weapons.
How does the statement from President Putin that he is going to mobilize up to hundreds of thousands more troops to fight this war, that he's in this for the long haul. How does that change the war right now?
Please bear in mind that at the beginning, before the war happened, the experts were saying it would be enough for Russia to conquer the whole of Ukraine within 72 hours. However, they failed to seize the whole of Ukraine. You can see an attempt to save face, and this mobilization, this partial mobilization, which was announced in Russia, well, it causes a horror among his society, because thousands of Russian soldiers have already died in Ukraine. There will be further thousands following. This is going to be the policy of the Russian authorities right now, so we can see a weakness of Russia in this respect.
So are you saying, you keep referring to Russian weakness, are you saying that the rest of the world should not take his threat seriously when he says we're prepared to use all means necessary, and clearly they have an enormous nuclear arsenal?
First of all, nobody attacked Russia. Nobody attacked Russia. The Russian aggression in Ukraine is a totally unprovoked aggression. Number two, they've committed murders there, and they know that today they are threatened by criminal accountability. Therefore, the Russian authorities and Vladimir Putin started to threaten. What can they threaten with? The only thing they can threaten with is nuclear weapons. If this Ukraine, which is defending itself, which has no nuclear weapons, if this Ukraine is attacked by nuclear weapons, even to the smallest degree, even if they were the so-called tactical nuclear weapons used, the most modern ones, the smallest ones, that would break the world taboo. And Russia would find itself on the margins of any sensible political debate whatsoever. The whole world would turn its back on Russia. Even those countries which today support Russia silently or openly, even those countries will find themselves in a dramatic position, and they will have to say that Russia will have violated all the principles.
So what should Ukraine and the West do right now? You are describing Russia as backed into a corner, making threats out of weakness. What should Ukraine and the West do? Provide more weapons to Ukraine? What needs to happen now? Where do you see this going?
One should support Ukraine in a consistent and stable way, also by providing military equipment to Ukraine. Why? Because in order to be able to speak about an orderly world, about a world in which peace is going to be guarded and protected, then Ukraine has to regain control over its internationally recognized borders. One has to support Ukraine to make sure that it defends itself so that Russians are forced to withdraw from Ukraine to give back the occupied lands to Ukraine. And then we have to help Ukraine rebuild itself. This is the most important task facing us today. Ukraine has to regain its territory. Russia has to withdraw. The primacy of international law has to be restored.
Are you absolutely confident Russia will not use nuclear weapons?
Well, this is a question which you cannot give an answer to. Nobody can be sure of that 100%. Russia, which has never used nuclear weapons so far, and I want to stress this point, never ever, even in the times of the most acute Cold War, even in the times when the tensions were running high, Russia has never applied nuclear weapons. And in particular, it has never used nuclear weapons against a state which is not equipped with nuclear weapons itself. That would break all the taboos. And I believe that the Russian authorities know that perfectly well. It is not only Vladimir Putin, also the inner circle of Vladimir Putin, also the strategic military decisions.
The West has been largely united against Russia up until now. But if this war drags on for a very long time, with the economy being what it is, with winter coming, are you concerned at all that that unity could come apart?
Of course, this situation is very challenging. There are two overarching topics. First of all, the energy crisis, and secondly, inflation. Of course, on top of that, there is a third extremely important topic, namely the food crisis. But the question that arises is as follows. If we want to have an easier life, if we want to pay lower prices, are we going to agree for the sake of that to one of the nation's independence, sovereignty, and freedom? Can we agree to one European country which wants to be a democratic state, which wants to belong to the Western community and be a free, independent state? If we agree to that, then Russia will not stop. It will want to bite off other pieces of territory. It will want to seize the Baltic states, perhaps my country, Poland. Perhaps it also wants to seize Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Slovakia. This is the former Soviet sphere of influence. We have to say no to this, and we are saying no.
Last question is about your country, about Poland. You are clearly siding with the West in opposing what Putin and the Russians are doing in Ukraine. At the same time, your country has taken what is seen in the United States by the U.S. Biden administration as some extreme positions. There was a challenge to independent television network. There are questions about the independence of your judiciary. Your country's policy toward abortion is a very extreme. There are extreme limits on abortion in Poland. So my question is, as the United States looks at your government and the positions you've taken, the question is raised, is this a country that's moving in an authoritarian direction or in the direction of democracy? What's your answer?
First, let's start with the following. Poland is a sovereign, independent, and free state. The program which is being implemented in Poland, including the political program, is the program which voters wanted to have. These are purely democratic principles. This is how it functions in Poland today. I'm listening to my voters, and hence I'm making decisions which I believe meet their expectations. They are just decisions and correct ones in their perspective. I believe the President of the Republic of Poland has got this authority in our country and has constitutional powers. The President has instruments to stop any given amendment. Everybody knew who I am and what my convictions are when I was running for president. I was not hiding anything. My mandate is the mandate which I won democratically, and there haven't ever been any doubts about that in Poland. And I'm implementing the mandate today with full responsibility.
We are going to leave it there. President Duda, we thank you very much for talking with us.
Dziękuję bardzo.
Thank you very much.
As we have reported, Russia's President Vladimir Putin doubled down on his war in Ukraine, ordering Russia's first mobilization since World War II, calling up hundreds of thousands of reserves and retired fighters. He said more manpower is needed to win a war, not just against Ukraine, but against its Western backers. Anna Navaz has more.
That's right, Judy. The call-up of Russia's 300,000 reservists, a referendum in Russian-occupied regions of Ukraine on joining Russia, and a stark warning from Vladimir Putin to the West that he is not bluffing when he talks about being ready to use nuclear weapons. It has been an eventful, foreboding day. So to understand what all of this means at this juncture in the war, both on the battlefield and in Russia, we turn to Natalia Bugayova, Russia fellow at the Institute for the Study of War and author of the book, How We Got Here with Russia, the Kremlin's Worldview. Natalia, welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you for being here. So people are looking at this decision, Putin's order, a partial mobilization order, and calling it an act of desperation. What do you think? Do you see it that way?
Let's be clear. The reason why Vladimir Putin has made the decision is because Russian forces are not accomplishing their objectives in Ukraine. Putin has invaded Ukraine in February with insufficient force, which he has then exhausted at pursuit of very limited gains. His efforts to replenish that force through other means, short of full mobilizations, have not produced the outcome he has expected. So this is his way to reconcile the gap between his unchanged intent to control all Ukraine and Russia's rapidly degrading capability to do so.
Who are these reservists, though? What do we know about them and their skill level, and what kind of a difference could they make in the war?
Yes, I think the impact of this decision will not help Putin reconcile the gap between the intent and capability. We will know the full impact of this decision in months to come, but I think Russia will face a number of challenges in integrating these forces. The first one is quantity. I think desertion will be an issue. We know that many Russians support the war rhetorically, but they're not willing to fight in it. Additionally, I think Russians will face challenges in equipping, integrating these forces, training them, and also capacity to deploy them, which requires officer cadre and increasingly diminishing resource in the Russian military. I think equipment is also going to be a challenge. Russia has used some of its best forces and equipment already in this fight, and the shortcomings of Russia's defense industrial base are increasingly a problem. And as long as the West keeps and expands the export control on electronics, equipping Russian forces and reproducing advanced capabilities militarily would be an increasing challenge.
So we're seeing the impact of some of those sanctions when it comes to defense production as well. But what about the impact back home in Russia? As you mentioned, Russians may support it in voice only, not necessarily being willing to fight in the war. Could this decision further erode support for the war back home?
So I think Vladimir Putin's value proposition to his people for many years has been a promise of great Russia. And this value proposition is being fundamentally challenged now, in large part by setbacks of Russia's military in Ukraine. I think he's increasingly facing a challenge and need to reconcile unreconcilable objectives. On one side, keeping up this promise of great Russia, eroding capability to deliver on it, but also unwillingness of Russian people to fight for this vision.
Do you think there's concern among Russian people that this could lead to a full mobilization? Are we seeing that on the ground?
Yes, I think so. And we've seen Russian men trying to flee the country now, and some of the largest search on the internet for how to essentially escape mobilization. So yes, I think it's an increasing concern.
There was, in his remarks, that not-so-veiled nuclear threat as well. And you just heard President Duda of Poland there say no one knows what President Putin will do. Let's be clear, they have never used a nuclear weapon before. But at this point in a war that's now dragged on much longer than anyone, including Vladimir Putin, thought, explaining, as you have, where the landscape is, are we closer to Putin potentially making that kind of decision, either on a nuclear strike on a NATO nation or a tactical strike on Ukraine?
I think the strike on a NATO nation is highly unlikely. I think we cannot rule out Putin's use of a tactical nuke in Ukraine. However, there are two really important points here. One, Ukraine has been taking that risk since the day it chose to push back on Russia in this war. And it's Ukraine's and Ukraine's decision only whether to continue running that risk. So far they have, because the alternative for many is worse. It's Bucha, it's Izum, and we've seen what it looks like. I think secondly, there's a question of what such a strike would accomplish. And in my assessment, it will is unlikely to break Ukraine's will to fight, which is one of the two key centers of gravity of this war, together with the Western support.
What does all this mean for Vladimir Putin back home? Does this make him, you know, the seven-month war now, having to call up 300,000 reservists, does this make him more politically vulnerable?
I think he's not imminently vulnerable, but he's more vulnerable than he has been in years, precisely because his value proposition is being challenged. However, we will see how he will react. He has been proven to be able to calm protests for years. But one more constraint he faces now is that a lot of his suppression apparatus is being deployed in Ukraine, such as Rosgvardia, which is National Guard. So he's facing an increasing limitation in that regard as well.
What are you watching in these next few days to see how those remarks play out on the ground?
We're watching the reaction of Russian people to the mobilization. But I think the most important things to watch will come in months, not in days, and specifically how Russia will integrate this force, how it will train it, and what effect it will eventually produce on the battlefield, which I do not think we will see until 2023.
Natalia Bugayova, Russia Research Fellow from the Institute for the Study of War. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Hurricane Fiona is expected to hit Bermuda hard as a Category 4 storm as early as tomorrow. But when it saturated Puerto Rico earlier this week, it did extensive damage as a Category 1 storm and set back the modest progress made since the island was hit by Hurricane Maria 5 years ago. William Brangham reports on how the storm has affected communities across the island.
Just days ago, these lakes between houses were in fact roads. Since then, Hurricane Fiona has moved on from Puerto Rico, leaving the island and its residents to reckon with the damage left behind. For Zulma Vasquez, the memories and fear she felt 5 years ago with Hurricane Maria came rushing back.
When Maria happened, it was nighttime, and only my mom and I remained. She was 93 years old, bedridden, disabled, and we almost drowned. I couldn't leave her. I thought this was going to be the same, or worse.
She had finally rebuilt her roof before Fiona hit, and this time it withstood the storm. She was one of the lucky ones. Many homes across the island were badly damaged. Vasquez lives in the fishing town of Los Naranjos in Vega Baja. It's located in the wetlands between the Cebuco River and a natural reserve. Founded by freed slaves over 100 years ago, it's a tight-knit, family-oriented community. Carla Medina, one of Vasquez's neighbors and mother of two, has to sweep up Fiona's mess. The storm dumped an estimated 20 to 30 inches of rain across the island. The Cebuco overflowed its banks and sent 2 feet of water into her home. To save what she could, Medina stacked furniture on top of her bed. During the storm, she fled to her mom's house because it's on higher ground. Ricardo Loriano works on flood control and other projects here. He says, in a warming world, these kinds of disasters will only become more common.
People need to start being more aware of how we need to manage climate change. We can extend our lives if we do a good job restoring the ecosystem. That's what we need here.
Marisa Rojas, a local community leader, says the aftermath of these storms is always the real challenge.
One of the biggest impacts are the floods. Many times, people don't even know where it's going to come from. During Maria, the effect was the next day, not during the hurricane.
For many, it will be a long and bumpy road to recovery. As the sun goes down in Los Naranjos, volunteers distribute food and drinking water for those who need it. About 40% of the island still doesn't have potable water. But this aid isn't enough to calm the greater feeling of gloom here.
We have no water, no electricity. We are in the ends of time.
It's even worse on the other side of the island, where the storm has left its mark on Yauco. Located in the southwest, it was one of the hardest hit towns. Cesar Ramos just bought a house here, about a month before Fiona badly damaged it.
We were told that this area was flood prone, but not to this magnitude. And what we're dealing with now, that surprised me. We were not prepared.
Now, having strengthened into a Category 4 storm, Fiona is making its way north. Heavy winds have damaged Turks and Caicos after dumping heaps of rain on the Dominican Republic. It's set to hit Bermuda next. But the communities Fiona has torn apart along the way are now left to pick up the pieces. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
Outrage over Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' decision to fly dozens of migrants to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts last week is facing legal challenges. Yesterday, some of the migrants filed a class action case against DeSantis and other Florida officials, accusing them of discrimination and of violating the migrants' due process rights. And an investigation is underway in Texas, where the flights originated. Stephanie Tsai has more on that.
Advocates for the migrants say they were tricked into boarding charter planes that left from San Antonio and eventually arrived in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts last Wednesday. Now, Sheriff Javier Salazar, a Democrat serving in Bexar County, says he's launched an investigation into possible crimes. His jurisdiction includes San Antonio, and the sheriff joins me now. Sheriff Salazar, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. I'm going to jump right in. Why have you decided to launch a criminal investigation? What laws do you think may have been broken?
Well, just the way we have the obligation to do whenever criminal allegations comes to us is we have to investigate it. Some of them end in criminal charges. Some of them are unfounded. At this point, it's way too early to tell which way this one will go. Being that our alleged victims and or witnesses are on the east coast of the country. So what's at stake right now is we have to determine, did someone with boots on the ground in Bexar County break the law? If they did, we have to take in what it is that the victims and witnesses are telling us and then make that determination was a law broken while they were here in our county.
Okay. As you may know, Sheriff, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is now named in a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of these migrants. And the complaint alleges this, that he and other officials, quote, designed and executed a premeditated, fraudulent and illegal scheme for the sole purpose of advancing their own personal, financial and political interests. Sheriff Salazar, is that the kind of thing you're looking into? And is Governor DeSantis a suspect?
Well, no. I mean, I think to say that Governor DeSantis is a suspect is a long stretch. What my concern is and what I have authority of is my corner of the world, which is Bexar County. My concern is, did somebody with feet planted on Bexar County soil break the law or not? At present, we're being told that that's a distinct possibility by these folks speaking to us through their attorneys. But very soon, we'll have the opportunity to talk directly to them. Find out exactly what they were told and what was done with them and to them while they were here in Bexar County, and then we make that determination. Beyond that, anything that may have occurred with them in Florida, anything that may have occurred with them in Martha's Vineyard may be heartbreaking for us to hear, but I can't necessarily say that I have purview over or that it was illegal here in Bexar County. Our concern is what occurred in this jurisdiction.
Sure, but I have heard you say in a press conference earlier this week, Sheriff, that you have heard the allegation that these migrants were lured. You used that word, that they were lured under false pretenses into a hotel and then onto a flight. Is there any evidence of that yet?
Well, that's the allegation, right? And right now, the allegations are coming to us through attorneys that represent these folks. I have preliliminarily seen some partial written affidavits that would indicate the same thing. But again, until we physically hear it from the victims and witness or alleged victims and witnesses themselves, right now all we have to go off is secondhand information through an attorney. While I have no doubt no reason to doubt what these attorneys are telling us. For our purposes here, we need to hear it directly from the person affected.
Yeah, but I do recall you describing the action of sending them to Martha's Vineyard on this flight as disgusting. So you've given your opinion on that. The governors of Texas, Florida, Arizona, they have been busing migrants out of their states to cities like Washington, D.C., New York, and Chicago for months. And some Republicans have even pointed out that the Biden administration itself relocates migrants at times. Why is this flight to you, sir, to Massachusetts, different?
Well, because if you're telling somebody you're going to point to this place on the map and you know, you're going to be treated this way, this way, and this way once you get there. Here's what we're going to give you once you get there. And it's full disclosure, and they go with you willingly. That's one thing. And whether I agree with the politics behind that or not is immaterial. But when you lie to them to get them to that point on the map, and then what was promised to them doesn't come to fruition once they get there, that could be problematic. And as I mentioned, it could, quite frankly, be criminal.
Authorities have stopped more than 2 million migrants at the southern border this fiscal year. It may be political theater, but this whole Martha's Vineyard flight has drawn attention to what many would say is a broken immigration system. Is there good that could come out of this, Sheriff?
Well, I mean, to make a point, you know, you put together a presentation or a PowerPoint, or you produce a video. You don't use real people to illustrate a point. You don't use real people, and then, as I mentioned, this is what the allegations are. You don't take real people in a country that they're unfamiliar with, to a part of the country that they've never heard of, and drop them on an island that they know they have no idea about. That's not what you do to make a point. These are human beings. And whether somebody agrees or disagrees with the fact that they have certain rights because of where they happen to be born on a globe is immaterial. They're human beings, and in my opinion, they shouldn't be treated in such a manner, especially in light of the fact that the allegations that we're hearing is that they were lied to get them there.
Sheriff Javier Salazar of Bexar County, Texas, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you to Stephanie Tsai. And on our website, a year after Hurricane Ida hit Louisiana, many are still trying to recover, especially those who work in the fishing industry, which saw more than $500 million in damages. You may read more about what that meant for fishermen's livelihoods and the future of the industry on our website. That's at pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.